From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast, hosted by Paul Hanley.
I'm here with François Godemont, who is in town this week for the Carnegie Global Dialogue, the third series in the Carnegie Global Dialogue. François is the director of the Asia and China program at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He's also a research associate at the Asia Center in Paris, which he founded in 2005. And I'm proud to say he's a non-resident senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in the Asia program, which makes him part of the Carnegie family. And we're delighted that he's here this week in Beijing. And we're delighted that, François, that you're on the China in the World podcast. Thank you.
Good morning, Paul, and thanks for the opportunity.
We met yesterday in a roundtable with Chinese scholars discussing EU-China relations. You described the relationship between China and the EU as big, but also spontaneous and asymmetric. And if you could, we could start, maybe give our listeners a sense of why you say that. Help our listeners understand that. In what ways is the EU-China relationship spontaneous and asymmetric, and why is this?
Spontaneous is an important development because we have the feeling that all trade with China was government-directed, and then there's for a long time been an obsession in Europe with what you might call political trade. That is, it was through diplomatic action that you would gain traction in China, and that the Chinese were doing vice versa. Today, some of this still lingers because people worry about the big state actors inside China. For example, the big SOEs, the state enterprises, sure, are probably among the main investors from China in Europe. But my
In fact, we just saw a big one with ChemChina.
Although everybody treats it as a Europe, but it's also Switzerland. And it's a very peculiar context of placing your money in Switzerland at this point. I think the $43 billion that ChemChina spent are also a ledger way of putting money into Switzerland. So it's a bit special. But to come back to your question, my retort to the notion that this is all government driven is that the state enterprises themselves have their own dynamics and their own concerns, that it's pretty much fragmented, and that China lends itself to a lot of spontaneous relations, a lot of bilateral relations, without necessarily a very strategic grand plan. The second factor is human. There's zillions of Chinese tourists in Europe. With hot money flowing out, as has been happening in 2015, there is a lot of under-the-radar investment, including in real estate, including in education, which sort of places the relationship in a different category today. Now, the asymmetry...
Can I ask you before we move on to
yes.
that? How about the private sector in China? Is that also reinforced this notion of spontaneity? Is it?
I wouldn't place that much accent on the private sector, because moving in Europe is not so easy. It requires a lot of knowledge about the legal environment, about the regulatory environment. It differs from country to country in spite of the European Union. And we often hear from Chinese firms, particularly private firms, that they're not yet well able to deal with this, with the complexity. They don't necessarily have the support systems that Western companies have with lawyers and consultants and banks that
so
act.
So it's still mostly the state-owned enterprises.
In that sense, yes, but as I said, fragmented and with a lot of incentive to do this anyway, a lot of competition among firms. So that is important. By contrast, there is an asymmetry because Europeans can't do a lot of things in China that the Chinese do in Europe. To be clear, there are communities, for example, of Chinese citizens residing in Europe now. In Europe, they're probably more than, in France, for example, they're probably more than 600,000. The number of foreigners in China including Europeans, is maybe 1/20th or 1/30th of that. The regulations, the barriers to entry are important. We've lived through the era of the WTO accession, which liberalized trade in goods. But today, all the strategic stuff happens in services, in the virtual economy, in finance, in public procurement as well. And these are areas which have been less liberalized from the Chinese perspective. So whereas the European market is, it's complex, not necessarily easy to navigate, but it's open.
In order to address the asymmetry and also the uneasiness in the EU about being taken advantage of in certain cases, you've argued that Europeans would benefit from a more ambitious and straightforward approach to negotiations with China. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean the Europeans have hang-ups about Chinese investments in some crucial areas, chief of which is public procurement or an investment in large infrastructures, because in Europe that's synonymous also with the welfare state, with social and public concern. It's not merely a question of cost price analysis. And by doing that, whereas, you know, you can buy cheap wiper blades and cheap aluminium wheels, for example, from China, it's not yet done to buy a cheap subway. It's another area. It raises more alarm bells in terms of the social consequences of doing that. I personally think that Europeans should be more open. I would call it a second opening and a second discussion with China. But it has to be done in a way that leverages this to get some reciprocity, to get some advantages from China. The Chinese actually need to park some of their cash into Europe. They have sunk a lot of money into questionable deals in the energy producing and raw material world ever since 2001. And they're currently beginning to sink a lot of money on the way to the Silk Road in areas which are not necessarily completely stable or safe. By contrast, Europe appeals in terms of security, but we need to leverage that. And that would be to our mutual advantage to do more. It's a strong economic relationship, but it's something that's worth contemplating.
On the overcapacity issue, we've seen this fall, this issue of steel imports and the protests that followed subsidies placed on steel after that. You made a distinction yesterday between the steel case and the solar panel trade dispute. Can you talk
about that? Yes, I can amplify that. I think it reflects on the changes regarding China. At the time of the solar panel issue, the European Commission was often criticized by member states for being too tough on China. Solar panels were thought to be a little marginal. Nobody wanted to pick up a quarrel. Everybody wanted the investment. And it's very striking that this time around on steels, it's the member states that are pushing the Commission to lean a little harder on China. In part, steel is socially more important than solar panels. It's an established industry with unions. We've been going through very painful restructuring in Europe. But in part, it also reflects growing doubts about China's economic policy. First, the notion that it will export its problems to others. And second, the notion that, after all, there are ways in which we can resist some of the trends from China when they're negative. So to see economic ministers, including from countries that never approved anti-dumping generally, not even against China, but also against others, to see them sign on is an interesting development. It means Europe is moving towards realism. It doesn't mean that it's getting tougher on China, but just that it might be able to get it back together.
Now, in China, for the first time in several decades, we're beginning to see doubts about its current economic trajectory, slowing down of the economy. You wrote recently a piece called The Facts Behind the Myth, which talked about China's economic downturn. Do you believe these worries about the slowing economy and the future of China's economy are overstated or overblown?
They are absolutely overstated when one talks about the coming crash. And when one, you know, focuses on the bubbles, to say the bubbles will bring down the house, China is a huge economy. It's partly speculative. It's also in the Chinese character, by the way. Even if it wasn't government driven, there would be even more bubbles. It's traditional. And second, we got hooked, literally, on 10% plus growth.
Right.
We should pay attention to the fact that Chinese themselves for years have been saying that the rate had to go down under the I mean, the former prime minister always said
deliberate.
That.
It's a deliberate slowdown. Yeah.
Yes, which doesn't make the consequences less painful for those who will suffer from them. My piece was also a warning to partners of China that they would, rather than congratulate themselves on the fact that in the end the Chinese economy is slowing down and some of it is getting bogged down, we should be concerned with the parts that are renovating, that are going up, that may be irresistible, for example, in the virtual economy, which are making China actually more advanced, more competitive, leapfrogging others.
This is the so-called new economy.
Yes, and I think this is very serious. Chinese society is more plastic, more flexible than many others, in part because it has come out of totalitarianism, and therefore it accepts things. I'll take you an example. All over Europe, there are controversies on the car services like Uber or others. In China, it's gone in immediately without many visible problems. There are problems, so they're not so visible.
So a distinction between the old economy, the heavy industry and others, and the new economy. And
yes,
you're generally optimistic about trends in the new economy and what it means.
I'm attentive to the dynamism in Chinese society, which I think is fundamental
and it's innovation
that sort of rips away many doubts. On the other hand, if you look at the last year, it definitely proves that the government structure is not able to adapt very easily to financial management, for example, of markets, that it's going to be much more difficult having side by side the big state and all those new actors in the goods producing economy that was doable and cheap in the virtual economy. It's clearly more difficult.
Finally, if we could talk a little bit about China's Belt and Road Initiative. How does this fit into the future trajectory of China's economic development? And how does it fit into its overall foreign policy strategy, perhaps, with connecting Central Asia all the way to Europe?
You know, One Belt, One Road is a kind of convergence of several concepts and several layers in Chinese thinking. I don't think you can simplify it, except that President Xi Jinping seems to have a talent to get catchy phrases, which take like the China Dream or the regeneration of the Chinese road and now the new Silk Roads. He invented, after all, the maritime Silk Road concept. The truth is there is first conflict avoidance with the U.S., being influential in zones which are not under practical control of the U.S. Second, there is a very natural trend of expanding China's talent for building infrastructures to the Eurasian environment. And frankly, it's only in the past 30 years, because of wars and conflicts like Afghanistan, that we forgot that all these roads were passable. When I was young, the kids in my generation, they went over those roads very easily when they were 20 and 22. Nobody thought it was a big deal.
Right.
Today, it's again a big deal. So the Chinese are just talking about what you might call a possible post-war situation in Central Asia, through Iran and Afghanistan, to name two questionable, two problem countries.
Right.
The third dimension is really exporting capital.
Yeah.
And I think that we got to think, to see things right. Maybe the OBOR policy was conceived at a time when energy price was high and raw materials price was high, and Central Asian states were very important. But today they are very low. Central Asian states are maybe 50 million people. Europeans are 500 million, and with a huge market. So I think we have to pay attention to the fact that the Silk Road policy ultimately points to 1, 2, 3, 4 ways of getting to Europe and reinforcing the connection over land, over sea, over cash. And I think that's the, if there is something that survives from the strategic design of the Silk Road, it will be establishing those connections to Europe.
Well, Francois, thank you very much for joining us this week at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center, and thank you for joining the China in the World podcast.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.